Hello, everybody. Welcome to The Rest is History. This is the first of a series of bonus episodes that we're recording to go over the festive season, where we'll try to get through as many of your questions as possible. Tom, we have recently had, what have we had? The live stream where we talked about...
Talked about me. It was brilliant.
It talked about you, which you must have enjoyed.
Yeah, it's great.
At the final episode of JFK, and we had The Savage Storm, which was an episode with your brother about the Allied landings in Italy.
People will also have had Zadie Smith on The Tichborne Claimant. And we had quite a struggle, didn't we, to work out what title to use for that. Because we thought The Tichborne Claimant, people would have no idea what it was.
No.
So we went for Victorian Britain's Maddest Mystery.
Yeah, which it kind of is, to be fair.
Oh, I think definitely.
Yeah.
So that's good. And then we've got one coming up on The Windrush. And then we have a festive edition, which we're going out on Christmas Day, which is going to be all about Roman Christmas.
And just on The Windrush, Tom, 50% of our listeners, if not more, will have no idea what you're talking about.
Well, you're the historian of modern Britain, you tell them.
So The Windrush was a ship that arrived in Britain, the SS Empire Windrush, in 1948, bearing migrants from the Caribbean. And it has become this sort of, dare I say, Tom, sacral symbol.
Well, I was going to go for totemic or iconic, but yeah.
It is sacral. It's one of those things that people get very misty-eyed about, don't they?
One might almost say mythic.
Yeah, because it's seen as an avatar of immigration and sort of multiracial Britain. I was about to say multiculturalism, but that's not quite right. It's kind of multiracial Britain. And what I like about that episode is that Trevor Phillips, I guess, so he co-wrote the first real history of the Windrush and its legacy. And he's quite into sort of digging into the myths and stuff, isn't he?
He is, yeah.
He doesn't turn all misty-eyed.
He has a fascinating take that surprised me
on
the idea of the Windrush as an icon for the whole of multiracial Britain.
Right.
Which, you know, no spoilers, but it's very interesting.
Yeah. To be honest, I can't remember anything that happened in the episode, so you were going to spoil it for me then.
You'll find it interesting too then.
Yeah, when I listen to it back. And so you mentioned that you've got your episode about Christmas in ancient Rome coming up. Mm-hmm. But actually, next week, it's a Tom Holland double bill, which is very exciting. Because what will you also be doing?
Well, there's another one that's set in Rome, and that is The Mystery of the Pregnant Pope, which is another another title that we spent a bit of time working out.
So when I read in the notes, The Man in the Iron Mask, that is incorrect. It's not The Man in the Iron Mask.
We're not doing The Man in the Iron Mask because we haven't had time to record it.
Okay. So it's the female popes, right?
Yeah.
Pope Joan.
So the female pope, Pope Joan, story that either in the 10th or the 8th century, there was a female pope, a woman who had disguised herself as a man, was elected pope.
Yeah.
And then rather embarrassingly gave birth.
Crikey.
While riding from the Vatican to the Lateran Palace. And throughout the Middle Ages, it was widely held to be true.
That's kind of on brand for the Catholic Church, though, isn't it?
Yeah. The papacy itself gave it its imprimatur.
Yeah.
And the question is, where did the story come from and why would the papacy have approved of it?
Yeah.
So I think it's very interesting.
Now, Tom, you sound a little bit softer than usual. I think there are possibly two reasons for that. One is that you've been moonlighting on another podcast and you're feeling guilty and therefore speaking a little bit more softly than you otherwise would. And two is you've been moonlighting on another podcast and they've turned your gain down on the box. Or was it both?
It's the second one.
Oh.
I feel no guilt about going on leadership.
No one knows, Tom. No one knows.
So that's presented by our sister podcast, The Rest is Politics. So Alistair Campbell, who was Tony Blair's spin doctor, and Rory Stewart, who was recently seen playing Cato, a man who nobly set himself against tyranny.
Yeah.
Never actually made power, but died a martyr.
And for our overseas listeners, they won't know who Rory Stewart is, Tom. Who's Rory Stewart?
I've just explained who he is.
That's his claim to fame. He walked across Afghanistan. He was a failed minister under Theresa May. Boris Johnson kicked him out of the Tory party. And now every week he records a podcast about how much he despises Boris Johnson. That's pretty much it, isn't it?
Yeah, I think that would be a harsh summary, but not untrue.
Okay.
He has written one of the great books on British politics that I think will be read in 100 or 200 years' time.
Oh, yeah.
Which is a record of his time as a minister over the past decade in the Conservative government. And it's brilliant. It's wonderfully written. It has absolutely venomous pen portraits of all the various Tory prime ministers that we've had over the past decade. Yeah. But it's also simultaneously funny and kind of appalling on why British government doesn't work.
Okay.
So anyway, so I'm on that talking about Christmas, talking about Jesus and stuff, you can imagine.
Okay, very good.
All the usual.
All the usual.
So that's going out on Christmas Day as well, I think.
As a rival to our podcast?
No, complimentary.
Complimentary.
So there's loads of me on Christmas Day.
Yeah, what more could people want? All right, should we do some questions, Tom?
First of all, just before we do that, prompted by what you were saying about Trevor Phillips.
Yeah.
People coming from the Caribbean. Did you see in the Daily Telegraph, there was a feature saying that actually Nelson wasn't opposed to abolitionism?
I did, Tom.
And had the brilliant phrase, Nelson didn't hate anyone, and if he did, it was the French.
I did see that. I did see that. Yeah, I did. Will be aware, Tom, that I'm about to start writing my Adventures in Time on Nelson.
Exactly. So I was wondering what your take on this was. Just for overseas listeners, it is in the Daily Telegraph, and the Daily Telegraph is the newspaper more than any other one that would back Nelson.
Yeah.
I think that would be fair to say.
I was delighted to see it, Tom. It turns out that lots of these letters have been faked.
Mm.
There were multiple letters that were faked after Nelson's death by proponents of slavery to imply that Nelson was a supporter of the slave trade. And he wasn't, because this isn't the first time this has been alleged.
Although against that, I have no way of knowing. I haven't looked at it any more than just reading the Telegraph article.
Yeah.
But Michael Taylor, whose book on the fight against abolitionism, I think you reviewed, didn't you?
I did review it, yeah.
Anyway, he plays cricket with me.
Yeah.
He said it's definitely not fake.
Yeah.
So I don't know. But he also has a dog in the fight.
He's got a massive dog in the fight.
Yeah. I mean, everyone has a dog in the fight. So
he's got a massive slavering dog in that fight, Tom. Sorry, I was distracted while I was talking about Michael Taylor, because I just received a text message. I'm going to read you the text message. It says, "Hello, Jess. It's Amber, Dylan's mum. I spoke with Scott rehaving Henry over this week. Does Thursday work for you?"
Wow.
But I'm not Jess. I don't know who Amber, Dylan, Scott or Henry are. I feel there are too many names in that text. It makes it suspicious.
Do you think it's a code?
I think it's some sort of trick. I don't believe that anyone would send a text message of two lines with five people's names in, none of whom I know.
But they might do it Christmas, mightn't they?
Right. Theo's saying shut up and ask some questions.
Yes, all right.
Let's go.
But just on the Nelson.
Yeah.
I do think it's interesting that people really don't want him to have been in favour of the slave trade.
No.
But it is perfectly possible, because I'd have thought that he would be in favour of it because it would keep
Britain strong,
the Caribbean strong, and therefore enable us to beat the French.
Tom, we don't want to get cancelled, do we? People have feet of clay, so if Nelson turned out to have unfashionable views, it wouldn't bother me particularly. I mean, lots of people have bad views.
Well, like Napoleon.
Well, anyway, I don't want to drive away our listeners.
All right.
Ask the question.
Okay. Caput Nili. What iconic Christmas event would you like most to attend? The coronation of Charlemagne, the completion of St. Paul's Cathedral, Washington crossing the Delaware, or the 1914 Christmas truce?
I wouldn't really like to go to any of them.
Wouldn't you?
Not really. I'm not going out on Christmas Day. If I suppose I would have to go to one, it would be St. Paul's Cathedral, the completion.
You wouldn't like to see the coronation of Charlemagne?
I wouldn't. I just think, I don't know, a load of old Franks, hairy, sweaty kind of...
I'll tell you why I would enjoy that.
Yeah, go on.
I would enjoy watching how shifty the Pope looked.
Right. I'd rather hear you talking about the coronation of Charlemagne, Tom.
All right.
The Christmas truce? I mean, demented. Why would you go to the Christmas truce? There are no man's land.
I have to say, it looked quite touching in the video for Paul McCartney's Pipes of Peace.
Right.
You ever seen that?
And Sainsbury's advert as well. The Sainsbury's advert did a very nice advert.
Yeah, I wish they ripped off.
So you know the Christmas truce? Since we don't actually have tons of questions written down on this piece of paper, I feel licensed to go off. The great account of the Christmas truce comes from Henry Williamson, the author of Tarka the Otter.
The fascist.
Wonderful children's book. And of course, yeah, exactly. So what makes this so interesting is that he served in the First World War on the Western Front. He wrote beautifully, absolutely beautifully, about the experience of the Christmas truce, about going across no man's land, exchanging gifts with Germans, singing hymns with them, realizing there were people like himself, all of that stuff. It's an absolutely tear-jerking scene.
I've never read it.
When they're singing kind of Silent Night and all these things.
When did he write it?
He wrote numerous different versions.
But when was the first one? I mean, is it possible it's been contaminated by the myth, or is it documentary evidence that it might actually be true?
No, I think there are other accounts by other soldiers of similar things, but his is the best. I wrote about it in my Adventures in Time, actually, and I found it really moving to do so. He wrote, I think there are letters home. I think he wrote letters home, but I might be wrong. Anyway, the fact is he came back from the Western Front and he was so traumatized. He was like, well, never war again and all that kind of thing. And then he went on that kind of slippery slope that we've discussed in previous episodes, where you go from feeling there must never be a repeat of the Great War to it was a terrible mistake and a crime. And then you go from that to feeling very guilty about the peace settlement. And then you go from that to thinking, those poor Germans, you know, allow them to have their pride. And then the next thing you know, yeah, you're a bit of a fascist.
Mm. He was a kind of nature-based fascist, wasn't he?
He was a nature-based fascist, exactly. Yeah. But a lot of sort of intellectual fascists were sort of nature-based fascists, weren't they? Nostalgic. I mean, that's the interesting thing about fascism, that it kind of can seep into, or other things can seep into it, I think. Which is why I always sort of intellectually anxious,
yeah,
if I am ever intellectually anxious, Tom, when people just sort of say, well, fascism is evil and it's in its box and everything else is good kind of thing. Because I don't feel like you can actually corral it off from the rest of politics and culture in that way. I think that's what's insidious about it, is that people can easily slip into kind of fascistic sounding themes or metaphors or ways of thinking without really knowing what they're doing. Don't you?
I absolutely think that the environmental strain in fascism is unsettling.
Right.
I mean, I loved Tarki the Otter and his nature writing.
Yeah.
And it is unsettling.
Yeah.
So Rolf Gardner, who's the father of John Elliott Gardner, was also into this kind of thing.
And John Elliott Gardner, Tom, for 99% of our listeners,
is the great conductor.
Okay. Thank you. And he's a fascist.
His father was, yes.
Right.
Well, he was kind of fascist adjacent, I think.
Okay.
But he was very kind of, you know, woodland, the ancestral roots of the English people in the woods and things like that.
Right. Badgers.
Badgers.
Like you. Yeah.
Well, were I to become a fascist, I think that would be the route that would probably get me there.
It would be the Stonehenge stuff that would draw you in, wouldn't it? The despoiling of the English landscape.
All that kind of thing. Yeah.
Big government.
Yeah.
Modern bureaucracy. You'd be kind of back to the land. You'd be more kind of a guildsman of the 1910s.
I would. Yes. Elected pygmies.
Yeah.
Disrespecting the ancestral birthrights of freeborn English, all that kind of thing.
Time to end the democratic experiment.
It's all gone wrong.
Yeah.
Another question.
Yeah. Here's one for you. Yorkist, nothing to do. Been watching TV's Tom Holland's new show about Julius Caesar. In the opening title sequence, Baroness Warsi, she says that if we don't look after democracy, a new Caesar will come. I always thought Caesar was a uniquely gifted individual, says Yorkist. So does Tom agree with the mighty Baroness?
I think, first of all, I think it was Baroness Chakrabarti, not Baroness Warsi. So Baroness Warsi is a Tory former cabinet minister, and Baroness Chakrabarti was director of Liberty, which is a human rights campaigning, freedom of speech type organization. And I think she is now a Labour peer. So they're on opposite sides of the political divide. But the substantive point about the role played by Caesar, I barely know how to begin with this.
Okay. There's a lot to unpack here.
It's such a Moebius strip of anachronisms.
Yeah, because there was no democracy in the Roman Republic. There was some voting, but it wasn't a democracy.
There were elements of democracy. And Caesar, in his justification for crossing the Rubicon, said that he was defending the rights of the people. It was the senatorial elites led by Cato.
Yeah.
So Rory Stewart's great hero, who essentially was subverting the constitution by denying the rights of the tribunes of the people. And the tribunes existed to give the masses a voice, to countermand the kind of the drift towards oligarchy that was inherent in a republican system in which the senatorial elites had so much power and authority. And Caesar presented himself, not illegitimately, as the champion of what you might call the democratic traditions within the Roman Republic.
Okay.
So no.
Yeah.
That series framed Caesar as a kind of Trump, a Johnson, which is why Rory was so keen, I guess, on playing the part of Cato.
Yeah.
But you could also cast Caesar's opponents as people who were attempting to roll over and emasculate and neuter the popular traditions within the Republic.
Okay.
So the democratic traditions.
Yeah. So the kind of Mandarin classes.
The Mandarin classes. Well, no, I mean, more revolutionary than that. They're not Mandarins, because Mandarins imply a kind of disinterested, above politics kind of stance. You know, these are all actors. And Rome has been, you know, within living memory, has gone through bloody purges led by the leader of this faction, who was Sulla, who put up prescription lists in the Forum.
We should absolutely do Marius and Sulla and their rivalry at some stage, Tom. I would love to do that.
Yes. I mean, I absolutely think that casting Caesar as a tyrant, plain and simple, couldn't be more wrong. And I, I'm slightly embarrassed that that is slightly the editorial stance that got given on this, but I had nothing to do with that. And of course, the overarching thing on this is that it's insane to see the very, very different political system of the Roman Republic.
Yeah.
Purely in terms of the politics of 2010.
Thank God our second episode of The Rest Is History wasn't called Is Trump Caesar or Nixon? That's actually the title of the episode, Tom.
Yeah, we were groping our way then, weren't we?
To be fair, they were in the hands of executive producer Tony Pasta then. And that was the kind of stuff he liked, and indeed still does.
Well, no, to be fair, we were entirely complicit because we thought we should put in something that both of us could talk about.
Yeah, that's true.
But you're not having any of that now, are you?
No, it's totally Tony's fault. Totally Tony's fault. Although documentary evidence does show that Tony came up with the title, The Rest Is History.
Yes, not Podpast.
Not Podpast.
Could have been so different. Okay, so Acalia.
Yeah.
Why do we have a fixation on dynastic political families? And I'm guessing by this, Acalia means in democracies rather than in monarchies.
Yeah.
There's an obvious reason why there'd be
a
fixation on dynastic political families in monarchies. So he or she is citing Kennedys, Clintons, Bushes, Adams, Pitts, Chamberlains, Churchills, Nehru, Gandhis. Are we intrinsically conservative and value blood lineage, or is it a lack of ingenuity?
It's not a lack of ingenuity. The reality is that even within a democratic system, you know, having a parent or something, or a very close relative already involved in politics, obviously opens all kinds of doors. It could never be otherwise, because they open doors to factions, to patronage networks, to sources of funding. It doesn't have to just be money, but it could be all the kind of institutional capital that you need. The contacts, knowing who to call, knowing what to do, knowing what to say. It could never be otherwise. There's no system that could eliminate those advantages, I would say. So that's, as politicians, as sort of consumers of history, as readers, the reason we're interested in this is because of family drama. We narrativize our lives through the institution of the family to some degree. And we're naturally drawn to sort of family sagas, aren't we? To stories of son following father, daughter following mother, or whatever. So much of history is narrated through the device of the family. I mean, the monarchy, an obvious example. So I think it's completely understandable why the generational sort of churn should fascinate us as much as it does. I do think it is remarkable that in the United States, in the last 50 years or so, really, you know, a couple of families have dominated presidential politics. That's a sign of how much that kind of patronage and that fundraising matters, I suppose.
So you're looking forward to the presidency of Baron Trump?
Baron Trump, yeah. Or Jenna Bush.
Have you seen him play football?
No. Somebody was telling me about it. Dom, our erstwhile producer, was telling me about it, wasn't he?
Yes, it's extraordinary. Just to go back to the Roman Republic.
Yeah.
One of the things that's interesting about that, of course, is that people in the Roman Republic thought the political dynasties weren't just acceptable, but were brilliant.
Yeah.
So if you were the first person in your family to become a consul, it was kind of seen as, you know, an achievement, but you were still looked down on. The really brilliant thing was to have hundreds and hundreds of ancestors, and people would put up in their hallway, they would put up the death masks of all your ancestors, like a great family tree. And there'd be a great trumpeting of this.
Wow.
And the voters loved it. The voters were much, much likelier to vote for someone who had, five consuls.
Yeah.
And a consistent record of winning magistracies over many centuries than they were someone that they'd never heard of.
So here's the question, Tom. Do you think we've moved as far away from that as some of us or some people would like to think, or not? In other words, is there more prestige based on, I was the first member of my family to go to university? I believe this is Keir Starmer's line, isn't it?
As it was famously Neil Kinnock's, wasn't it?
Yeah. The great problem is that generally people from their generations who did go to university were always the first person to go to university, because university entrance in Britain was so small beforehand. So actually it's a meaningless phrase. Anyway, that's by the by. So do you think there's more cultural prestige based on being the first person to go to university?
Absolutely.
You clawed your way up by your fingertips. Or do you think there is still a lingering sense of, you know, here's my great-grandfather, all that stuff?
No, I think that's a problem. And the moment that struck me that that had changed was during the leadership election after Mrs. Thatcher got defenestrated.
Douglas Hurd.
And they had Douglas Hurd, who was very, very posh, and he described himself as a humble tenant farmer.
Yeah.
And I thought, no, you're not. He was appealing to Tory MPs who have, you know, all the constituencies in Britain. They would be the ones who would be all in favour of, oh, my, you know, great-grandfather was the Duke of whatever.
Yeah.
And he was embarrassed by it. So I would say, absolutely, people, you know, completely bury the fact. If they do have pedigree, they're embarrassed about it.
Are they embarrassed about it? I think they're publicly embarrassed about it, but privately, they're very proud. Don't you think?
Well, I wouldn't know.
Among their own kind of set. So the reason that Douglas Hurd did that, by the way, was that under Mrs. Thatcher, people said the Tory party had changed from being the party of estate owners to the party of estate agents.
Yes.
So in other words, for our overseas listeners, from people who owned real estate to people who...
sold it.
Yeah, sold it. Exactly. Which to some degree, there's obviously a large estate agent proportion in the Tory party right now, isn't there? Okay, Theo's telling us to shut up. A humble tenant farmer, he says, like you, Tom, talking about your Scottish estate. How would you rebrand that?
I don't need to.
Yeah.
I glory in it.
Yeah. Right.
So we should wish everyone a very happy Christmas.
Yes. Yes. This episode, you said it was all going to be festive, but it actually just went completely off piece and ended up talking about fascism.
Well, that was because you were such a grump. You were like kind of a Grinch. I tried to set up a festive thing about, you know, thanks to Caput Nealy and
yeah,
his list of festive things that had happened. And you just weren't playing ball.
I saw a load of questions there about Aztecs and JFK, and I thought, brilliant.
Yeah.
Great. I'm laughing. And then to my horror, you just skipped them.
No.
Just absolutely skipped them.
It's like reheating turkey on January the 11th. We've so moved on from that.
January the 11th. That's harsh. You'd have it in a cassoulet. I'd have it in a cassoulet. That's my recommendation. That's my top tip. Have a cassoulet.
Anyway, listen, Theo's getting increasingly irate. So enough. We should stop.
Yeah.
But just to say, very happy Christmas, everyone. And we will see you after Christmas and just before New Year.
Happy Christmas. Bye-bye.
Bye-bye.